Hello, hello. Welcome to the inaugural episode of the Ethos of Aid podcast. Could my smile be any bigger right now? I imagine you can hear it. I am, to say, a little excited. My name is Kimber, and I'm your host. And in this first episode, I reveal myself for the newbie podcaster I truly am, and share with you the first sliver of my perspective on humanitarian aid work as I've experienced it in the field over the last 20 years. I thank you so much for tuning in, and I thank you in advance for your patience. I will get better at this, so I hope you'll stick with me. If you enjoy your experience, please let me know. This really is a space for dialogue. You can find me at kimbervredenburg.com and hit contact. You can also follow me on Instagram at kimbervredenburg or leave me a message on the Ethos of Aid Facebook page. Again, thanks so much. I'm delighted you're here. Let's get started. I found myself putting this episode together and getting in a bit of a muddle, and this morning it really came to me. What do I love to do? I love talking about this work when I'm not doing this work. And when somebody simply asks me to tell them about my work, it's a beautiful thing, and I can go on for a very long time. So I've crafted this episode in that format. It may change, but this is what I'm going with today. So I imagine that I've been asked that question. And the first thing I want to say is that this work continually asks me to grow and reflect, to be transparent, useful, vulnerable, and live in my integrity. And I am fully aware of what a privilege it is to do this work. And that's my starting place. I get on a plane and I'm reconnecting to the parts of me that really only come alive outside of my culture of origin. This work starts with human connection. It happens at the heart level in the field. When we zoom out and take the bird's eye view, humanitarian work is vast. Think about the images that come to mind for you. In my mind, I see fields of tents, long lines of humans on the move, thousands of people crammed into tight spaces and urban areas. When we zoom in, down, 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 it's happening to and for people, real people in their real lives. There are images I'm sure you can call to mind when I say that as well. It's deeply personal, this work. And for me, it happens in moments. I've accumulated a vast memory disk of powerful moments in my mind. And those moments are distilled into the learning that occurred for the individuals involved, myself included. And much of this work comes down to the individuals who are giving and receiving aid, so that makes sense. Those of you who are practitioners know this. Those of you not in this work may or may not know that the people involved are volunteers and practitioners and staff, both from the context where humanitarian aid is happening and from outside of it. Just imagine that grouping. What we have is a vast array of humans with beliefs, values, social, cultural, and religious norms, systems, histories, biases, contradictions, and life experiences all coming together for the shared purpose of promoting human welfare, but from vastly different points of reference, or what we like to call in human services, vastly different social locations, the lens through which one views the world. You can call it what you like. What's important in this work especially is to be aware of it, because it influences every aspect of your way, of my way, and because we're working outside of our cultures of origin or working inside our cultures of origin, the need for awareness of all those things in our lens is more vital than anywhere. This is really beautiful, messy, human, complex work, as you've heard me say already. And then there are professional identities and bodies of ethics, and amazing things happen when humans come together in this way. In my experience, there's tremendous collaboration. And as I said, it's messy because there are humans involved. The definition of ethos is the characteristic spirit of a culture, era, or community as manifested in its attitudes and aspirations. I chose that name for this podcast because there simply isn't a single ethos in this work, because both the individuals involved and the context where it's happening are always changing. The humanitarian system agrees on the principles of humanity, neutrality, impartiality, and independence as fundamental to the work. But within that, each context is its own unique and beautiful labyrinth of beliefs, values, social, cultural, and religious norms, which necessarily influence the ethos of the work, the manifested attitudes and aspirations. And in my experience, as part of the humanitarian community, we don't honor, explore, and talk about or integrate that understanding into our programs and practices nearly enough. Let me give you an example, a small one, the concept of pace as a gentle entry. I got hooked on this work on a long, hot, slow walk out to a community in Malawi some 20 years ago. Malawians used to laugh at me when they saw me hurrying past. They would often shout out, "What's the rush? Hurry up and what? Die?" It made me laugh. And it was a powerful moment because I realized I came from a place that moved fast, that emphasized outcome rather than moment-to-moment process. And the context required me to match my pace with theirs on every level. From expectations around meetings, which were scheduled for 9 and often happened much later in the day, to achieving outcomes, to what that even meant. Growth and expansion take time, naturally. They and the humans involved deserve that time. Slow down. There were many moments on that long, slow, hot walk with a practitioner named Isaac Machinjiri in Malawi that stood out for me and carry through to this day. Isaac, at the time, was a marvelous young man serving his community of some 100 villages spread out over kilometers on foot. Rural Malawi was and likely still is a subsistence farming community. And for those of you who don't know, that means people are relying on the cultivation of their land for the food they eat. And at certain parts of the year, there just isn't enough food. And Machinjiri himself struggled each month to secure enough food for his family. Yet here he was on this walk, voluntarily going out to the communities to help them figure out how to feed the children who'd been orphaned due to the HIV and AIDS pandemic. Isaac was part of a committee helping to support these communities figure out the best way to do this. And they really were my first introduction to extraordinary local practitioners. So on our walk, we were talking about the social problems of each of our countries, as one does in this work. For background, prior to my arrival, I'd had 3 years, four in total, but 3 years focused training to become a human service practitioner for the purpose of working with vulnerable people at the individual, family, and community level. And it was a fabulous education program because we really spent 3 years digging into our own vulnerabilities, our biases, our beliefs, and values. So I had a lot of self-awareness at the time, but really, one can't ever be fully prepared for the expansion that happens in one's awareness, thinking, and feeling, and knowledge base, and beliefs until one steps into a context other than one's culture of origin. So when Isaac asked me to name some of the social problems in Canada, I said things like substance use, violence, and I heard myself say the words eating disorders, and he stopped. And his beautiful eyes bulged out of his head, and he asked, "Eating disorders? What is this?" And in that moment, I raced up one side of Maslow's hierarchy of needs and came crashing down the other side as I realized I was going to have to explain the concept of an eating disorder to a man who never had enough food to feed himself or his family. Now, this conversation wasn't about, nor is it now, about eating disorders. I'm not making any particular comment about eating disorders. What I'm pointing to here is that in that moment of dialogue, where both of our heads exploded, we recognize that there are problems generated by deficiency and problems generated by abundance. I came from a culture where most people had refrigerators, most of which had food in them, which afforded us the ability to think about things other than food. In so doing, it also facilitated a focus away from today and towards the future. Retirement savings came to mind. And it all suddenly felt a bit absurd to me, because even with the systems and the education and the privilege and the healthcare that all came with this and our expanded life expectancy, the future was still in no way guaranteed. Machinjiri's culture, by comparison, often didn't have enough food, as in the communities we were walking towards. And in his own words, he said, "We need to take the mangoes from the trees today, even if they aren't ripe, to sell them today so we can eat today." Now, in this moment, it's hard to share, having ever been quite that green, but there it is. We work with the consciousness we have at the time. I share it now because the underlying themes here keep coming up in my work 20 years on. So if we zoom out a little bit and you think about this in the humanitarian context with those principles I shared, and with the agreement that human suffering needs to be addressed and the emphasis needs to be on those most vulnerable, how do we define in this context who is most vulnerable? In fairness, Malawi at the time wasn't receiving humanitarian aid per se, as the system defines it, but there were many NGOs present trying to support the orphans. What about the practitioners? In most contexts where humanitarian aid is being offered, there are local people already serving their own vulnerable communities, often themselves affected by the same issues as their communities, so sometimes only slightly less vulnerable themselves than the people they're serving. And international NGOs come in and with the best of intentions and extraordinary levels of thought about all of this and conventions and policies, but there's a chasm between those organizations, policies, and conventions, and the lived lives of people expected to, for better and worse, be impacted by them, or perhaps expected to consider changing the way they live their lives as a result of them. Those NGOs are coming from the outside place, from the fast-paced place, just as I had been when the Malawians were asking me if I was in a hurry to die. The ideas, the policies, the concepts, however co-created, they are vital and they are derived from belief systems that do not always easily connect with those of the people they are aimed at helping. Practitioners, those of you in the field, you know this. Those of you working in your own contexts, you know this. And I know you know this because you tell me you know this as we're working together. This work always begins with these discussions and the concept of how to build bridges between the beliefs, values, and norms of these disparate individuals and groups. Humanitarian work, with all those incredible resources and best intentions, inadvertently enters contexts thinking about and planning for tomorrow and asks people who may be living for today to change the way they think, but not directly. Change the way they believe and the choices they make in asking for changes in behaviors. But that isn't explicitly stated a lot of the time. The system may not even be fully conscious of what it's asking in some places, because how change transpires is not part of the mainstream conversation really in humanitarian narratives. And most importantly, zooming back in my experience, what needs to be offered for practitioners and their communities is the space, respect, and time it takes to consider making such enormous changes. So there's a chasm between the belief structures, and practitioners in the field know this. And practitioners from elsewhere know this, yet we don't often talk about it. It's not built in. I'm sharing it here because it's been a theme of my work for over 20 years. I was in Ghana fairly recently, and I got to work with an extraordinary team. Shout out to Josephine, Julius, Portia, George, Uncle James. And this theme of the need to bridge beliefs came up yet again. Now, I was only there 3 days. 3 days. And I wasn't there to answer that question. So as I said, here I am, 3 days working with an exceptional team in Ghana. And they're implementing child protection programs in the cocoa farming plantations with the intention of introducing play-based learning into education and, more importantly, getting more children into education and out of farming. Incredible staff, incredible community-based work. And in the car on the way back, Julius said to me, "You know, in Ghana, people haven't really bought into play-based learning or even education, because we have a saying here that we want and expect our children to grow into great citizens. But most people don't really know what that means in terms of how to invest in their children today to create that future. Because people need to eat today. And because, and I don't think I'm going out on a limb here when I say this, the global system is still rigged in favor of the privileged and those who already have the financial wealth, the future can be really challenging for people in some contexts to see. So the beliefs, values, and norms favor the present over the future, necessarily so. And in humanitarian terms, zooming out, that's where the work has to begin. The work has to begin with affording communities the time, space, and opportunity to grapple with believing in a future they can't see, choosing so or not choosing so, and what it means to invest in their children's futures today. And to succeed in that, the practitioners in context who already possess this knowledge of all of the pieces of the contextual labyrinth and the relationships with community members need to be invested in as well. We need to support them in expanding whatever skills they feel are necessary to support their communities doing that level of work. The thinking work, the feeling work, the belief work. Creating spaces for considering making changes to beliefs. There are those in my world at the moment that say, beliefs are just things we've chosen to continue thinking about and they can be changed at any time. And to that I say yes, and they're also deeply emotional. And this is big work to do. It's important work. It's heart-led work. It demands integrity. These conversations require skill and vulnerability, meeting people where they are, and the willingness to be grown in the process. And NGOs typically don't invest in field practitioners and staff in this way. And so, these are the types of conversations I get to have. I get to work with incredible practitioners and go on those long walks or in the car where we talk about who we are as people, about our beliefs and values, what we hold to be important in life, what our purpose is. We really go below the titles and roles and the packaging and connect as mutual students of life. These are what create the ethos of this work. And the tiniest shifts happen here. Tiny but essential shifts. They are respectful, co-created, open-hearted shifts. I see the inherent value in honoring and investing in the local practitioners, the national staff, in every context. Well, that's a wrap. I'm feeling exhilarated and a little vulnerable for all I've shared. I can already see the things I'd like to change, but I'm going to blow through my perfectionism paradigm and let it go out into the world, perfectly imperfect, and trust you'll hold space for me and receive me as is. I would be so grateful to know even one thing you're thinking about now that perhaps you weren't at the start of the podcast. please let me know at kimbervredenburg.com by clicking the contact button, or on the Ethos of Aid Facebook page, or follow me at Kimber Vredenburg on Instagram. Remember to share respectfully, please. Own your perspective. Let's meet in the real. It serves us all, and it's really the only place I want to live. Thanks so much again for being here. Till next time.